From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. As we're recording this, it's awards time in Hollywood. All the studios are pushing their shiniest baubles onto the filmmaking community in the hopes that they will garner little gold statues that can help inflate the box office. This year is a bit different than most. The important studio movies are, for the most part, crashing and burning. How can you tell they're important? Because they're hugely expensive and at least 3 hours long. But the audiences are not responding, which this year is not surprising. Hollywood is spending a huge amount of time making bloated movies that moviegoers just do not want to see, Avatar to the contrary. What movies are making money? Those feisty little movies that go for the jugular. Genre movies, movies that scare you, make you laugh, move you in smaller, more personal ways. Movies that don't cost a lot, don't have a lot of financial risk, and movies that can afford to do something different and exciting. It may not be a great year for the studios, but it's been a surprisingly good one for the horror genre. Everything Everywhere All at Once, Barbarian, Violent Night, The Black Phone, Smile, Bodies, 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 X, Pearl, The Watcher, Fresh, Nope, Crimes of the Future, The Menu, Speak No Evil, no matter what your taste in terror, there was something out there for you this year. But of course, horror isn't tasteful. Aggressive cinema is an embarrassment to the hallowed halls of Hollywood, though it seems that's where the evolutions in film and filmmaking seem to embrace creative thought. Our genre is considered a gutter to the mainstream, but it's really the one where we can probe most deeply into the things we feel, the things we fear, the things we hide, the feelings we don't access lightly or gently. Our genre is a rude one, but it's one I gladly share with the ones of us. Gobble gobble. Our guest, Roger Avery, is a stalwart in the world of aggressive cinema. An Oscar-winning screenwriter and admired director, he also co-hosts the wonderful Video Archives podcast with Quentin Tarantino. We'll take a deep dive into rude cinema and beyond with Roger right now. So, Roger, what do you think the appeal of aggressive cinema is?
Well, It's probably a little bit of, first of all, thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, you nobody belongs here more than you do.
I'm really grateful to be invited.
it's great to have you.
It's a great pantheon, and I guess post-mortem means after death. And so this is
yes.
Where you go when you die.
That's
your,
right.
Your
when your career is washed up, it's a post-mortem.
Here I am.
Yeah. As if.
So, aggressive cinema. So, you know, I think what it is there's always a certain amount of envelope pushing that you're trying to do as a filmmaker. You're always trying to reveal you know, sort of forbidden fruits. And you're always trying to kind of push the envelope, I guess, is just the best way to put it. And when I kind of came about as a young man in the business, you know, I started out actually, like one of my first gigs was working for Charlie Band and wow. at Empire. And I was a runner projectionist there. And so I got wow. to see like around 1986, 1987, kind of what I would call sort of peak exploitation coming out of Empire and Charlie's company. And not too long after that, you know, I was making my, you know, my first film. And what happened was the explosion of DVD. I mean, DVD right. suddenly came on the scene and there was this sort of sudden need for product. And everybody was looking for product, and there was just this moment that occurred when at Live Home Video, when Ronna Wallace was running the company, and she was just, if you were louder than anybody else and more violent than anybody else and more wild thinking than anybody else, she was open to it. And she was ready to like make noise at this video company, because that's kind of what you need to do to get an end cap at the at Walmart or Target.
Right. Now it's streaming, where you have thumbnails to choose from, and yeah. you got to be loud. And
you know, truthfully, it's kind of the same model. It's yeah. it's sort of not too different a financial model. Everything has kind of moved sideways. It's just, weirdly enough, its residuals have changed.
Like, that's for sure.
And so Ronna, at that time, she made... let's see, it was Reservoir Dogs, Killing Zoe, Bad Lieutenant. And those were like the three that kind of got jammed into the pipeline really quick.
That's a pretty great triptych.
Yeah, it was a pretty great triptych. And that was a really amazing time for that company, which eventually, shortly thereafter, became Artisan Home Entertainment. And then that became absorbed okay. by Lionsgate.
Right.
And so in those days, the model, which, again, it's not too dissimilar from today, was, okay, we're going to make the movie cheap. We're going to make it for, like, you know, they'll tell you, oh, we're going to give you $2 million to make it, but you really only have like $1 or $750, you know.
I know how Charlie works.
Yeah, well, this wasn't for Charlie, but no, but it was the same model, basically.
He definitely inspired a generation.
And I was born in Canada, and so I have Canadian citizenship. And so I thought, well, this is going to be my path. And there was this company that was making, like, I don't know, they were making, I think, 12 movies in a row in Canada with the same crew. And right. they were just going to, like, you know, just like a sausage machine.
And they have and, a big, you know,
film number incentive. 8 fell out and we need somebody. And so they had me, and it's like, okay, you're Canadian and you qualify for this many points. And if you get a Canadian actor, and I'm like, well, those days I was thinking Keanu Reeves or Kiefer Sutherland, who are right. both Canadians. I thought I could use one of those guys. And, anyhow, I tried to assemble this movie. They said, all you have to do is now go get some foreign sales to cover the... That's all you have to do. And so I flew to Cannes. Like, I had no money at this time. I mean, I was pretty much broke, and I maxed out my credit card going to... basically getting a ticket, going to Cannes. Monty Hellman let me sleep on his floor.
Wow.
Because I couldn't afford a place. And I would eat hors d'oeuvres at parties because I couldn't afford to eat. It's like, and every now and then I would run into somebody who was like, oh, you're up and coming and I'll take you to lunch. Like some attorney or agent or something would take me to lunch, and I would, like, you know, I'll have two entrees.
Just like, let me take some home.
Yeah, exactly. And while I was there, you know, trying to basically sell territories on that film, everybody kind of who had seen me trying to hawk my script around Hollywood, Killing Zoe, which I should even wind back a little further, because it was really Lawrence Bender who his right. call to me that
the great Lawrence Bender. I did a pilot for him years ago, Lost in Oz.
Yeah.
Where he was my producer. Yeah, a wonderful guy.
Lawrence was one of the young guys we knew who had actually made a movie. He made a movie with Scotty Spiegel called The Intruder.
Yeah,
which was a monster in a supermarket. They had a supermarket location, and they were like, we got this for a week for free. If we can get, you know, kick together a couple $100,000, we can make a monster movie. And I think Lawrence maybe knew John Buechler,
the makeup effects guy,
and like, we can, you know, make this happen. And they did. And so Lawrence, they were making Reservoir Dogs at the time, And Lawrence and Quentin had scouted a location at a bank, and they were like, wow, this is an amazing bank location. If only we had a script that took place in a bank. We don't need a bank because Reservoir Dogs doesn't need a bank.
Right, right.
And so Lawrence started calling writers he knew. He's like, hey, do you have a script that takes place in a bank? If you do, I can make a movie.
This is a great way to approach film production.
Yeah. And
we have a bank. Let's write
a script. Exactly. And I had been working at Empire. And so I had sort of seen like Charlie's system, and I had learned from, you know, David Schmoller and Dave Dakota and all those guys and all and the editing staff there. Like they had always, you know, let me sit in on edit sessions and, hey, you want to cut some? Cut a piece of this movie. It's crap. It's like, go for it. And so, you know, I kind of learned a bunch of early tricks, you know, working on movies like Crawl Space,
right,
and stuff like that, RoboJocks, and all the Stuart Gordon movies.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
things like that. And so to me, I that was the closest thing that I had in that moment to the Roger Corman School of Filmmaking, which when I grew up, I was like in love with. I was enamored with this idea of the Corman School, where you could just walk into his construction yard studio in Venice and, you know, hustle a little. And next thing you know, you're directing a movie.
But by the 90s, that had kind of faded out.
That had kind of faded. And Charlie was there. And I kind of quickly realized, well, Charlie's system wasn't really, I wasn't really able to rapidly advance from a guy working the projector and running around editing elements to director. And I was like, that's not going to happen fast enough for me. And so I basically bumped into Lawrence. And Lawrence had already made The Intruder, and he was getting Reservoir Dogs going. It hadn't yet gotten going. But he called me up and he was like, hey, do you have a script that takes place in a bank? And I was like, yeah, I do. I do have a script that takes place in a bank.
And so I'll give it to you in 3 days.
That's exactly what it was. It was a long weekend. I hung up the phone. I started writing. And by Monday, I had this script, which I based on, you know, not really out of my life, but I based on this kind of European trip that I had had, where I'd met these French guys that I thought I knew from Los Angeles, who were completely different once I started hanging out with them. And they were all heroin addicts all of a sudden. And it was like,
and I
was like kind of just so naive about that. And so it was sort of like a, so in writing very, very quickly, I just sort of spilled a bunch of that into it. And I ended up with this script. And then I proceeded to go out and we started getting it going. And it just kind of, the first path was, oh, we'll try to do the Canadian thing.
Right.
And they were like, forget the bank in Los Angeles. Like we couldn't get the money going, really. It was like everybody in Los Angeles had met with me. You know, I had walked into the doors of both high and low in the business, you know, from, well, I probably shouldn't say the low, but you know who they are.
Yes.
You know who those guys are. I met everybody, and everybody basically had kind of said no to us. It was a little too weird of a movie with the French elements and that it took place in France, and I was planning on shooting it in Los Angeles. It was kind of hard for people to wrap their head around that. And I was like, but it's a movie. You just, you know,
we make shit up all the time.
Yeah. Darby O'Gill and the Little People is shot in Burbank.
Yes,
and that is the most Irish movie as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And so it's movie magic, right? And but it was hard for people to wrap their head around, you know, the just the nature of it. But for me, that's exactly what they used to do at the Corman School. You know, you would get somebody who's like, okay, you're going to make a woman in prison film, and we've got the, you know, Hell's Angels to be in the movie, so it's going to be a biker film also.
Right.
And, okay, go. Just keep it in focus, kid.
Yeah.
And you'd go out and you'd make the frickin' best women in prison film, you know, you can.
Topless scene every 10 minutes, yeah.
You'd figure out how to make that art. you keep 1 foot in exploitation.
Demi and Kaplan did it.
Yeah, exactly. 1 foot in art house, and you end up with these movies that are just, I think, wonderful. And they always tend to be genre films.
Yeah.
Just because genre movies, they tend to feed the genre need, you know, that the audience wants. But then at the same time, it's a good way, and you said it very eloquently, to hide social commentary, to hide political commentary, to, you know, we see all sorts of great stuff. Actually, Joe Dante just popped into my head as he frequently does, because I absolutely love him. But his Masters of Horror one, for example, which is a zombie movie, but it's also a very powerful political statement.
Yeah, we showed that at a festival in Torino, in Italy. It got a 10-minute standing ovation.
The city of Argento, no less.
Exactly. And he was there.
Oh, was he?
And of course, he had done one for each season as well.
Oh, yeah. Argento. Well, so I... So this was something I was like always wanting to do. I want to make an art house movie. I like that. I like all movies, but you know, I like very esoteric art house films. I wanted to make Killing Zoe to be something like if Werner Herzog was making sort of a grindhouse film.
Right. You know? Because it's got element. It's a smart grindhouse movie. You know,
saying that it was smart.
It's a creamy, but it's a French creamy.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, well, that'll make it a little different. And okay, so that was like a little too much for people to think about. But by the time I had gone to Cannes and I was, there hawking my wares there, because I now realize, okay, if I can't make it in LA, suddenly this Canadian opportunity came up and I'm Canadian and I was going to be film number 8. And so I go to France. Again, I'm sleeping on Monty Hellman's floor. I'm starving. I'm selling stuff. And suddenly people start seeing me and they're like, hey, it's that kid who's from LA. It must be real.
Yeah, he's here in Cannes.
And suddenly, like in that moment, Russell Mulcahy actually signed on to direct a vampire script that I had written called 99 Days. Uh-huh. And which to me was like in the moment while in Cannes that happened. And so Republic Pictures, who announced the movie, and it was like they gave it a big full page thing. And in that moment, in that single moment, just because I was in Variety and my name was on a, and my script was on a thing, suddenly they were like, oh, something's happening. And so this French producer, Samuel Hadida, said, oh, I will buy France. And since you're here, and Benelux, it comes with Benelux. I insist on Benelux because he's like a wheeler dealer, shyster stealer.
Yeah. Sammy Hubby.
Sammy. I love him, but I'm also, I wrestle with him emotionally. And Ed Gala actually got into, near fist fights with him when we were working on a movie together in France.
Oh, dear.
So he's like, oh, well, who do you want to be in the movie? And so at the time, I was really, really interested in Erin Jacob, the girl who was in Red, the Kieślowski film.
Right.
And so he said, well, I'll introduce you. And I really wanted Jean-Hugues Anglade, who I had seen in Betty Blue, and Nikita as well. And in fact, before I went to Cannes, I went to the video store I went to Video Archives, the video store that I used to work at.
We'll get into that.
And I got a whole bunch of tapes out of it. And using two VCRs, cut together my own teaser trailer using elements of, a documentary on the Louvre and elements of Nikita, La Femme Nikita, and all these various movies, a little bit of Betty Blue. And I made a little trailer out of it. And I took it to Cannes with me. And that way I could kind of show people. I later found out you're actually not allowed to do that. You're not supposed to. It's like some kind of copy. But it's not for broadcast. Yeah. It was just to give people an idea of what the movie would look like or feel like. And cut it together. And I kind of sold it like I'm making a very... Like I never told anybody I'm making an art house film. I said, I'm making a really super sexy thriller. It's going to be like an action thriller with like sex. And there's going to be a sex scene. And there's going to be... it's going to be a thriller. Like I didn't really tell them I want to do like this kind of... sex, death, vampire, Nosferatu, kind of very unsexy sex scene in Killing Zoe, but that's what I did. And so Sammy said, well, why don't you come to Paris after Cannes and I'll introduce you to these actors. And I was like, oh my God, this is it. It's happening. And I had to go back through Paris anyways. And so I delayed my flight home and I went and I checked into a hotel I couldn't pay for. At this point, I was maxed out. Wow. But these were the days before they had computers on your credit card.
So they couldn't.
They would just take an impression of the card. And so they took an impression of my card and I checked into this little tiny, tiny hotel and I proceeded to meet these actors. Sammy started introducing me to these actors. And Irene Jacob said, no, I'm waiting for Kieślowski on Red. And so it was like a big letdown. And then Jean Hugues came in. And at this point, he's a huge star in France. He was peaking in France. And he came in and they sat down. He and his agent sat down with me, Donna Sien, she's his French agent. And they sat down and they sat across from me. And he leaned over and said, Jean Hugues, this is his agent talking, loves the script so much. And what's the movie so bad? What do we have to do to convince you that he's right for the movie? And I was like, well,
I'm going to be very demanding.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a very demanding person. But I told him what I always tell the actors that I'm working with. I said, listen, this movie is going to have no money. It's going to have a very small budget. It's going to be a very tough shoot. It's going to be super demanding. I'm going to ask everything of you. And if you're not game, don't worry about it. Like, I think
this is your first movie.
Yeah, I'll tell them, you know, I'm going to take you to the Coul de Monde, which is like the asshole of the world. I'm going to, you know, this is my first film, but I want to be honest with him. And also I found that the more I tell people that, the more they want to do it.
Right.
The rougher they think it's going to be early on, the more exciting it actually is.
Sure.
And the more honest you are with, like, look, we don't have resources. I've had actors on my films, like, we don't have resources. They start picking up, you know, when things go south, we have to move or something. They start picking up boxes and cables and moving them with me, even though you're really not supposed to. But by that point, everybody's kind of, you're in it. You're not necessarily doing it for the money. None of us are going to get rich doing this, is the foundation that I tend to begin with, which I learned from Charlie.
But it's a couple years. It's the same year as Pulp Fiction that the movie comes out.
Well, yes, this movie was made before Pulp Fiction, and actually, and just after Reservoir Dogs. Like, we were in prep when Reservoir Dogs I was in post on this movie when Pulp Fiction was just starting to ramp up.
Right.
And so I was actually doing color wedges and stuff like that right when.
And they both came out in 94.
They both kind of. Well, this one, I think Killing Zoe came out in 93, like late 93, okay. October of 93, okay. And then kind of hung around a little bit in New York and Chicago.
Right, right.
into the new year. But it was like, it was kind of happening. It was happening for Quentin, and I was absolutely catching some of that.
This tiny little movie that started to get some attention, particularly at film festivals and the like. But then you and Quentin had written Pulp Fiction together, and suddenly this became a game-changing movie out there, and you became an Oscar-winning screenwriter.
Which completely fucked me up.
So tell me the effect that it had on you personally as well as professionally.
Well, it was an intense rush of success very quickly. It was like one day you're eating cockroaches to stay alive and the next day they want to blow you. It's like, it's a very strange, actually, even with Killing Zoe, it was kind of like that. Killing Zoe was like that. I remember making the movie was a very, very intense, you know, rigorous, rough experience. And I ended up penniless at the end of it, having worked for Sammy, ended up absolutely penniless afterwards. And then I go to Sundance with the film, and they wouldn't let me in to the proper festival because they said it's a foreign film. And I said, no, but I'm like an American filmmaker. And
right.
I am a U.S.
North
citizen.
American.
Well, I'm a dual citizen. I really am. To that point, I had never returned to Canada since I was a baby. I had grown up in Arizona and Los Angeles.
Okay, so it wasn't Manitoba. That's just where you were born.
That's where I was born, and like a month later, we left. But I've kind of always kept my Canadian identity, even though I had never returned until I made Silent Hill. That was actually the first time I had returned to Canada.
Interesting.
And so I'm really a Canadian by...
by birth only.
Although I've always heard about the reputations of Canadians as being so friendly and nice, probably because like when the snow sets in, you're relying on your neighbor to stay alive.
and then most of the industry moved to Canada.
Yeah, well, and then the Canadian thing. I always thought, well, you know, if ever I'm, you know, if there's a draft or if I have to get a movie made, like the Canadian citizenship might come in handy.
Yeah, even in recent years, I've shot more in Canada than I've shot in the U.S.
Well, just for the exchange, it's, you know, just at the dollar exchange, at least at that time, especially.
And yeah.
At that time. But for me, growing up, you know, having been born in Canada and knowing the identity of Canadians, which is they're very friendly people in general, at least they have a history of being friendly. And so I always tried to live up to that in a weird way and to be friendly, like a Canadian, I guess.
Well, my company is Nice Guy Productions.
Yeah, exactly. And then also I grew up loving, you know, Canadian filmmakers. I mean, Cronenberg most prominently, but really, Norman Jewison most respectfully.
right. He's the grand old man of Canadian cinema.
To me, easily one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, and certainly one of the best widescreen filmmaker directors that I can I don't know, when I think about, this is a guy who made, not only did he make Fiddler on the Roof, but he made Jesus Christ Superstar. He's kind of, and both of them are so,
and 100 other movies,
and 100 other movies. I mean, he made Rollerball.
Yeah,
actually Rollerball. Like, what?
Well, he's like Robert Wise in that they could do anything, and they were expected to do anything in that era of filmmaking.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you're expected to be able to take material and, you know, and
a director directs.
Be a professional director with it and service the material first.
Right.
And do everything you can to elevate that material.
It became the autism thing, auteurism, not autism.
Yeah. Well, it's a kind of autism.
Sort of. But the auteurism thing may have been popular in France in the 60s, but it never really hit American cinema until the 70s.
Yeah, it was the 70s. I mean, but this was also, you know, the 70s and early 80s were a time when, I mean, I can remember going, and I'm sure you can remember, going into Westwood Village and Fitzcarraldo would be opening at the Regent or something.
Yeah.
And they would have like a giant poster for it of like, you know, Kinski and the boat, you know, and him like screaming into the pit, you know, like, as the boat is being pulled up the hill by all the natives and everything. Like, I think about that now. It's like, what a crazy time in history that movie, like this kind of crazy film like that, could open in Westwood.
Right, in a major cinema. Yeah,
yeah, that was awesome.
it was an amazing time. And I'm a guy who was born in L.A., lucky enough to be born where the business is centered, as Gala, I'm sure you were born in L.A. too.
Yeah.
But you
Santa
were...
Santa Monica. the best part of L.A.
St. John's? Me too.
Yeah, there it is.
But you were raised in L.A. or Southern California.
Torrance.
But
the land of H.D. Halecki.
And
like when I grew up right near Old Town. Do you remember Old Town Shop? Like I
know
lived,
it very well.
As a little boy, I mean, as like a 5-year-old, I could walk to Old Town.
Yeah.
And in those days.
Well, you know, Lou Zamperini, my father-in-law, was from Torrance.
Really?
And he's the guy Unbroken is about.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's kind of the hero of Torrance. Yeah,
and it certainly is.
From his World War II
Zamperini Field, right?
Yeah, it's named after him.
Yeah, named after him.
Yeah. But being brought up in L.A., what were the movies?
I didn't know that. That's why I'm kind of gobsmacked by that.
Well, people wonder, how did Mick Garris's name end up on Unbroken?
Yeah.
It's Angelina Jolie movie, big Hollywood movie like that.
And that's it.
Well, that's why.
Yeah. But him and also Lloyd Wright. Those are the two Torrance guys. But for me, it was like being a kid, it was all about Ferrells and...
the birthday parties.
And Old Town and Del Amo. And in those days, like when Gone in 60 Seconds opened, like H.D. Halecki would be out there in front of Old Town crashing cars together, like every day at noon, like before the matinee, they'd do a car crash in front of the theater.
It goes back to the days of William Castle and
everything. Yeah, and I mean, it's like the show in show business.
Yeah. Well, what were the movies and the movie makers who first engaged you and made you feel like, not only I want to do this, but maybe I can do this?
Well, so my dad... I wouldn't call him a sophisticated moviegoer, but he is a moviegoer, like a tried and true moviegoer. Like he goes to movies. He'll, even today at, you know, however old he is, like 90, he'll walk into a movie theater without knowing what's playing. And
he'll
say, I'll see that because it's that one's playing soonest. I'll go to that one. And that's a, That's a behavior I kind of love.
So the love of film is congenital.
Absolutely. And he would drag me into movies and go to movies. And then I remember when we moved to Los Angeles from Arizona was kind of what I would think would be the beginning of my movie
awareness.
And the first movie that we saw in movie theaters, I was in a proper movie theater for me, because everything before then was television. My earliest memories of media are mostly like Batman, which I was really into, like Adam West Batman.
Oh, yeah.
So Batman in black and white, I was like on our black and white television, I was really into that. And my earliest memory, my earliest memory is the end credits of The Prisoner, the Patrick McGoohan TV series. Like I can remember the penny farthing bicycle, the music. And kind of it's being assembled. And
Patrick McGoohan told David Cronenberg when they were making Scanners, I wish you'd been there when we were doing The Prisoner.
Actually, yeah. And I kind of even wished that when they had remade, and I haven't seen the remake that AMC did with James Caviezel.
No.
But I haven't seen it, but I kind of wish that Cronenberg had done that, because that would have motivated me to see it. I've just always been afraid to see that. I'm sure it's fine. I just have been afraid to see it.
I haven't seen it either. Yeah. But so what was that first movie?
So the first movie was Sound of Music, and it was playing at the Cinerama Dome. And so my first movie experience was, Sound of Music.
Wow.
Sitting in the theater and to this day, I can't watch that movie without falling to tears multiple times throughout the film. I think the movie is so powerful and so such a great family love story. And I just think it's a magical movie. I just love it. And probably because of that early ecstatic experience.
And in that theater of all places, which had a much bigger screen in those days.
Yes, yeah.
And it was a magical place to see a magical movie. No matter what was playing there, whether it was How the West Was Won or that, it probably would have been the movie that changed your life.
And it definitely did. Okay, so... I have a few other, there's a number of other movies that I saw with my dad, but the other ones that were really big, the one where I actually thought to myself, now I know what a director does. Now I understand what's happening when I go into a movie, was my dad took me into, and I think it must have been a re-release of some kind, but he took me to see Clockwork Orange, and I was young.
Oh, wow.
I was young, but those were the days when, like, hey, Exorcist is playing. Should we take the kids?
That was a big hit book. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I wandered into Clockwork Orange, as a young boy, and watching it, I consider the movie to be a very strong statement against violence. And that was how I took it as a child, because even the idea of conditioning being presented, or conditioning being the worst thing, that choice being the most important thing that we have as human beings, and when you take that away, what are the ethical consequences of it? Okay, so it's something that was super powerful to me, but more important was looking through Kubrick's eyes. I realized that when we sit in a movie theater, we're dreaming while awake.
Yes.
And we're looking through the eyes of someone else and watching their dream.
Yes.
And it's the closest approximation to that. And though movies have a kind of culmination of arts together, a convergence of all these different art forms together, there is one art form that is completely unique to cinema that we didn't see anywhere else, and that's the editing pictures. And editing of motion picture is and montage, and how Kubrick cut, made that movie to music, how powerful the movie is, the single point perspective, just everything about it, it gripped me so deeply and so Kubrick's talents got so deep into me. that
well, it's a remarkable.
It's my favorite film.
It's a remarkable experience for a child to see this movie and a sophisticated reaction that you had seeing it the way it was intended to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing this movie around the same time I'm seeing movies like, you know, Bugsy Malone or Muppet Movie or stuff like that,
which are great on there. Oh no, their
those are two actually Paul Williams movies.
Yeah.
Now that I think about
and
it,
you've worked with Paul.
Yeah, oh, yeah, and he was in Rules of Attraction. I mean, I called him up because I so adore, I mean, Paul Williams. I'm so, he means so much to me. His music means so much to me.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And so, yeah. So Paul, I had to call him up. And so I found somebody who had his number. They gave it to me. I called him up and he was just a consummate gentleman. He is the nicest, kindest, sweetest man. He's like, Roger, I've been waiting for you to call me. I've been waiting. And then he really put up. I told him it's going to be shit. It's going to be a shitty experience. It's going to be exhausting. We have no money. Like, same thing I tell everybody. Yeah. And he was like, I'll be there. And it was a tough experience.
Well, before we get to Rules of Attraction, I want to go backwards again because
you
had some things that really helped steer your career into filmmaking after winning an award for a student film you made.
Yeah, yeah. From the Los Angeles Film Teachers Association, which for me, having been a very bad student most of my life, for the Film Teachers Association to give me a gold trophy was, for me, a big deal.
And it led to time working in advertising.
Yeah, yeah, actually.
So tell me how that fed your work as a filmmaker.
Well,
and your education.
So I had been making, you know, Super 8 movies.
Yeah.
And regular eight, and then ultimately Super 8 films. And then even some 16 millimeter stuff. I had gone to a school called Art Center in Pasadena, Pasadena Art Center College of Design. And, you know, my classmates were, Tarsem, Sam, wow. You know, and, Michael Bay, and it was just all of us, and we're all making movies. And really, none of us have changed since then.
Right.
Tarsem was doing Tarsem things. Michael Bay was doing Michael Bay things. He was renting cranes on his films, on his student films right out of the gates. You know, he had Steadicams and shit. You know, and I was out there doing what I do, you know, making little...
gritty little thrillers.
Yeah, gritty little thrillers. That's genre films. And on Super 8 and scraping pennies together to make them. And and it was an advertising design school. And so the kind of path at that school at that time was you're surrounded by all these designers and design people and photographers and other kinds of industrial artists. Vehicle design people, product design people, stuff like that. And the path was make a reel of your work, of commercials, basically. So you take your, you find somebody in a product design class and they've designed a new water bottle.
Right.
And it's for a fake product. And so you do a water commercial.
And you're telling a story in 60 seconds.
60-second stories. And it's actually a super strong discipline to have to be able to do that. And it gave me kind of a profound respect of advertising and commercials in general. But I was also a little bit out of place because, as you can tell from, you know, the Video Archives podcast, like, I'm really like a movie guy and an exploitation film guy.
Yeah, this is a very buttoned down job.
And I got into like some arguments in a film class with the teacher who was teaching and a teacher who I very much respected and loved. I actually really used my favorite teacher, but we got into it over Lifeboat, over the Hitchcock film. And we ended up in a kind of theoretical argument about the future of the people in that boat.
Uh-oh.
And
my favorite thing, of course, is his cameo in Reduso, the Reduso ad. Yeah,
exactly. And so I had an offer to work at Empire. And I took that and I weighed the two and I was like, okay, I'm spending money I don't have. I'm spending my parents' money, which, and Art Center even then was terrifically expensive to go to. And I knew that it was my dad who was not really wanting me to go into film. He's like, what kind of that'll never happen. What a pipe dream.
Yeah. Yeah. You need something to back that up.
You should learn how to do, you know, shop and working on cars, or learn how to operate heavy machinery or something.
Yeah.
That'll, because my dad's a mining engineer. And so I was conscious of how much money of his I was spending. And then I had this job offer to my mind, with Roger Corman.
Right.
The new Roger Corman.
Which basically paid you enough to buy a hamburger every day.
Yeah, exactly. And so I dropped out of school after having this like crazy wild argument, this unreasonable argument, after which I was like, I left that class and I was like, what the fuck am I listening to that guy for? He does not know what he's talking about. I like him. He's a nice guy, but I can't learn anything from him. I can teach him things. I mean, I was arrogant. Quentin will tell you. I was absolutely an arrogant young man.
You were confident.
Super confident. I was super, super confident. You know, a confident person still questions themselves, but
you were beyond that.
I kind of have always believed that one of the things you need to make it in this business is, I have my three P's, which are, you have to be passionate. Because when you're trying to get money from somebody, when you're trying to, as you've done, sit across the table from them, you're trying to get money. Some executive or some producer or some financier who's been in this business and they're just deadened to it. And what you have to do is you have to ignite within them the passion that they had that got them into the business in the first place. Because all of us at one point were kids sitting in the theater like insects watching that flickering light, on the screen, and just loving it and wanting to dedicate our lives to it.
Okay, that's passion.
That's passion. So you've got to go in there because you've got to sell them on your passion and you've got to make them passionate. And so even when you're not feeling it, you've got to feel it. And then, persistence. You have to be persistent. There's plenty of talentless people that are making really good livings in Hollywood. Yeah. And it's not because they're talented. It's because they're the persistent ones.
Yeah.
Most people, when they walk into a dark tunnel and they start walking in and it starts getting dark and you start losing the entrance, the light of the entrance, and pretty soon you're bathed in blackness and darkness, and you don't know what's ahead. Most people logically will turn around and walk back out.
Right.
Okay, it's the filmmakers that keep walking forward with the belief, and you're going to guide your people with you. No, there is an exit.
Yeah.
You don't know that there's an exit, but you're going to like believe that there's an exit. You're going to will an exit into existence.
Because it's easy to give up.
It's easy to give up. It's and so you constantly have to be persistent. And because of that, you also have to utilize positivity or positive visualization.
Right.
You have to I always hear about like football players or baseball players. They see where the ball is before they throw it so that they know that it goes there. You have to visualize it being there and then it's there. And so I remember early on before Gala was born, actually when Gala was even when your mother was pregnant, her mother and I would just walk around for hours and we would visualize where we're going to be, what we're going to do, how we're going to achieve it. And every day was sort of like a focus of visualization of what the future was going to be. We're visualizing the end of that tunnel, the exit of the tunnel, the light at the end of the tunnel,
right?
You call it.
Roger Avery's three P's.
Yeah.
And then patience could be added, although it's sort of persistent.
And so along with that, confidence kind of does play into a lot of it because you have to confidently guide people into that. You have to confidently, convince people of your crazy idea.
You have to be able to back it up.
Yeah. And then you also have to show people that you're responsible because, you're making a movie with money and it is an industry and it's not, you're not alone. It's not me just with a Super 8 camera. And if the movie fails, it's doesn't just affect me.
Right.
It's not just my money. It's it's a thing. It's a business. It's show business.
Exactly.
And so I'm always trying, kind of maybe too much aware of that. If I could almost erase anything out of my own personality traits, it would be my knowledge of
awareness of the business.
My awareness of the business. Yeah. If I could take away my awareness, I think I would be blissfully ignorant of how barbaric it is.
Well, you also had the most remarkable film school in that you were at Video Archives with Quentin, both of you immersed in cinema.
Yeah.
Immersed in cinema.
Every day.
To this day, is still a huge part of your life because of the podcast, which is named after that video store.
Yeah, we're basically doing now what we did back then.
Yeah, like, we watch movies together and talk about them.
Yeah, we just get together, we watch movies. I mean, in those days, we would watch movies every night on video, whatever was coming out that week, whatever we got, whatever, if somebody had a bootleg of RoboCop that was going on, you know, whatever we had, we were watching in like this kind of rental that all the workers rented together. I just visited. I wasn't one of the people that lived there, but Quentin lived there. And so after work, we would do that. And then during work, we were doing the same thing. We were popping movies in and going and seeing them. And then every Friday, Quentin and I and whoever else would want to go with us, we would go see like three movies a day, basically. Oh. And those were the days when I think about that now that, you know, you could work on a minimum wage salary, you could feed yourself, you could rent a place to live, and you could go to a movie every day.
Yeah.
That's kind of...
That's gone.
Gone. Yeah.
That's gone.
That's kind of... If there's anything... If there's something wrong with our business, that's what's wrong with our business is that...
Well, it's... L.A. It has become such a cruel place. If you're a hopeful filmmaker, good luck finding an apartment without six roommates. You know, just... being able to find a job, being able to live, being able to feed your Jones for the movies.
Yeah. I mean, regular filmmakers who have actual careers are having trouble doing that.
Yeah.
Let alone, you know, the young kid with a sack over his shoulder coming into the gates of the city.
But you also found your creative partner in Quentin.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I worked on this movie, Lords of Dogtown, on the script for it. And I was never, though I grew up in a beach city, in Manhattan Beach and Hermosa Beach, I wasn't really like one of the surfers. I was the kid who was into movies. There was like the surfers, there was the punks, because there were all the kind of Red Cross guys, and the Descendants were friends of mine, and, Black Flag, they were at Redondo High, but there was a big punk scene in the Beach Cities area. And then there was all the surfers and guys like Frohoff and people like that who were surfing and probably going professional doing that. And then there was me and like my friends.
The movie
like,
geeks.
But when I worked on Lords of Dogtown, I was like, well, what's my entry into that movie? And then I realized Zephyr Surfboards, the little store that they had in Venice, that was Video Archives. Like to them. To people who loved surfing, you know, like that was it. And they were around at this kind of revolution that was occurring when we were going from clay wheels to urethane wheels. And that's like the video revolution. So suddenly these guys who were like, you know, the surfboard shaper, Skip Englem, who was very much like our Lance Lawson. He was like Lance, the owner of our store. He was the adult who had the store, and all the kids in the neighborhood who were into that would go there, and that became the clubhouse. You would hang out there, and if you could, you would work there.
Yeah.
Because like then you get to hang out there and you get paid for, you know, for being there.
Sort of.
It was minimum wage. But we got along on that.
Of course. And you could then.
Yeah, back then you could. Yeah. And so it was like everybody who was working there, even though it was a suburb of Los Angeles, of Hollywood, everybody loved movies. And everybody came there because they loved movies and because we were making movies and wanting to make movies. And I remember right around the time when Spike Lee did She's Gotta Have It and Soderbergh did Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Right around then, that was the moment Quentin and I were lifting off from Video Archives. And we were
the industry at the same time.
We were talking
time.
About it. Like, it's happening. It's possible now for a guy like Spike or Steven to ascend out of with these...
The Sundance
If you're smart with how you write it. And so Quentin and I came up with the Corman School theory, which was as few locations as possible, as few actors as possible, keep it theatrical and tight so that you can keep the budget low, like as few company moves as you can do. And so when I wrote Killing Zoe, that was like, okay, as few company moves as possible. That's the agenda, as cheap as possible. I got to have some I don't want to be crude. You have to have some breasts in it. I was about to like go wild, but my daughter's here.
Yeah, that's right.
keeps me sane. it's got to have some sex in it. It's got to have some violence in it. Obviously it's going to be a bank robbery. We're in a bank.
Right. But so this was a great launching pad for you creatively. You met your creative partner who stimulated each other in not just together, but in your own projects, which you bounced off of each other.
Quentin, I had been making little movies, and at this point, I was, though I was still working at Archives, I was also going to school at Art Center. I was just beginning that. And Quentin had this movie he wanted to make, this script he had written with a friend of ours, Craig Hammond, a super talented writer and director. And he, they had the script, My Best Friend's Birthday, which was hilarious. It was the first time I had read a script that any of us had written that was actually really good. I was like, wow, this is really good. This is really fantastic. This is like
instead of just a movie fan script.
Yeah. Instead of the stuff that we were like, you know, I had managed to at one point get the screenplay for Walling Green screenplay for Sorcerer.
Oh,
remember,
wow.
I got it from,
I love that movie.
It's one of my very favorite films. Yeah. And so that was like, of course, one of the scripts that I, you know, sought out. And I mean, it's written like a novel, the script, because there's so little dialogue in the movie.
Yeah.
And so you end up reading these beautiful. And so I kind of, that was my imprinting of like, you know, when you're a child, you look to your parents to imitate and to mimic so that you learn how to be. Well, when you're same thing as a filmmaker, you look to your cinematic fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers and grand, et cetera. you and your uncles and aunts.
Yeah. I mean, the guy
you imitate.
I mean, Steven Spielberg is the first guy to hire me as a screenwriter and second guy to hire me as a director. And it was film school doing amazing stories was, you know, having scripts directed by Joe Dante and Bob Zemeckis.
I have to confess to you, I was insanely jealous of you when we would hear about you back in those early days.
I was very lucky, but I got a later start than you did. You know, I was in my 30s before I was making a living doing it, and you were doing that. But I want to talk about adaptation too, because that's been an important part of your career.
Sure.
Before we get to
deep. I have one little anecdote I want to tell you.
When
I was doing Killing Zoe. Okay, so because it was. So we were driving around in location scouting, and everybody was stressing because we needed a, like, I had this look scene because when I was in France, this friend of mine was taking me around and we were like, is that cat dead? And I was like, no, that's cat's been there for days. Well, I guess it is dead. And he checked it, and it really happened. And so I said, like, oh, I put that in the movie. I wrote it into the script. And so we needed a dead cat, and it was, we had no money to make the movie. And so like, we don't have a dead cat. There's no dead cat. There's nothing to do. And so I remember we're driving down the road and I saw one on the side of the road, like a roadkill. And I said, pull over. The AD refused. He was like, no, he wouldn't let me do it. And that's when they decided to spring for it. And they said, you're in luck. Because there's just been this movie made, Sleepwalkers, and they have so many cats.
Yes.
And so we went to the warehouse at the prop place.
Oh, God.
And it was insane. It was like these giant shelves that go to the ceiling, like wall to wall on either side.
And I never
these giant
went
wooden
there.
Shelves. And it was filled with cats of every kind. What kind of cat do you want? Do you want a tabby? Do you want a black cat? Do you want a this? Do you want a that? It was like, they're all from Sleepwalkers.
Oh, wow. I'm kind of glad I never went into that building.
It was unreal.
That's so funny.
It was unreal.
That's funny.
Okay, now you can talk to me about adaptation.
Okay, well, now this is a good transition because we did a translation of Stephen King to the screen, even though it wasn't based on a book. But, you know, you adapted a game with Silent Hill, but most famously, Rules of Attraction. The Bret Easton Ellis book. I contend that there would be no Euphoria series if it hadn't been for Rules of Attraction.
I haven't seen the Euphoria series
it's
yet, but
amazing.
I understand it's really good, and I understand that Sam Levinson I understand that he pays homage quite a bit to Rules of Attraction, which I'm grateful for.
Well, you did a young people
I'm happy movie. Someone is able to monetize the...
but you made a movie about young people that they were unsavory, to say the least.
Yeah.
And that's not what the studios were putting out at the time, but it was very groundbreaking. And you threw all of the tools of cinema into it, all the tricks and cinematic gimmicks and things that really worked to propel the story. And you had a WB cast.
Yeah.
So people were not expecting James Van Der Beek and you know, the cast that you put together to behave in ways that they behaved in this movie.
I, well, first of all, I love adapting material.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoy it. I've, you know, adapted Beowulf.
Yeah.
I've adapted...
You and Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, me and Neil. And I've adapted, you know, The Life of Salvador Dali. I haven't made that movie yet.
Mm.
But I love doing adaptations and interpreting material. It's... there's something special about it. And
do you feel hamstrung in any way by...
Well,
because I've adapted King and Barker.
Yeah,
and
you know,
I
was actually meditating on your adaptation of The Shining,
hmm.
and thinking about it because it's true.
Fortunately, he wrote the script for that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's what's interesting is King is very, very difficult, I think, to adapt. I would think, because his what makes his writing so powerful, at least to me, and because I adore. King's work as well, and The Stand most especially. And
so good.
I think that you actually did an outstanding.
Oh, thank you.
Outstanding thank you. Job adapting The Stand, because that is almost unadaptable, and for you to condense it the way you did, and to actually capture it in the casting,
and he
was
wrote
really good.
Script as well.
I've thought a lot about how you cast the movie, and I was actually upset with you at that also, because I wanted to do The Stand. I was like, no.
I know there are things that, like when another filmmaker does something I really wanted to do. If it turns out well, then it's always forgiven.
Well, and I think because I was upset, I wouldn't give it my full attention at first. But then I revisited it afterwards once my emotions had settled down a little. And Gary Sinise is so perfect.
He's our Gary Cooper.
Yeah, he's so perfect in that role to play Stu. It was such good, and actually it really comes down to, there's two things you have to get right in making a movie. Only two things. You've got to get the casting right, and you've got to get the script right. And if you can get those two things down, then you can like almost shoot it out of focus.
Directing's easy. Yeah, if you've got
everything
those
is easy at that point.
Yeah.
If you can, and you nailed it on the casting on that film. It
thank
was really,
so much.
Especially in that moment, Rob Lowe,
yeah.
The casting of Rob in it. And so I really adore it. But I was thinking about The Shining and how it's more faithful than the Kubrick version. You probably don't want to talk about all of this.
It's okay. But
because this is probably like the bane of your existence. Like,
well,
having
except
this brought up.
When it but, came out, it got amazing reviews. And when Kubrick's film came out, it got terrible reviews.
Yeah.
But... yeah, it is the back and forth. King famously did not like Kubrick's film at all because Kubrick is ice and King is fire.
Yeah.
And
well, I have a story that you may have heard me tell about Kubrick, and this is a story John Milius told me.
Oh.
So Gala and I worked with John on... John had a stroke not too long ago and was unable to speak or write. And so we helped him to turn some of his scripts into series. So we're working with John. But before, I've known John for many, many years. I consider John like
a mentor?
My right-wing mentor.
yeah, right.
I don't mean to say that. I shouldn't say that. I consider him a mentor. I just, he's like a lion. The bombast of the man, you know, he and what he represents is a kind of an idea more than anything. Anyhow,
he's Red Dawn. Yeah,
he is Red Dawn. He is totally Red Dawn. Avenge me! But if you think about it, Red Dawn is a very smart movie. It's effectively saying it's understanding what other people are going through in similar situations that we maybe as Americans don't allow ourselves to identify with, and that's what Red Dawn is, and that's not a right-wing movie, I think.
No,
some ways. Even though it's called Red Dawn.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyhow.
He's an excellent writer.
Anyhow, yeah. More to the point. John told me the story that one day Stanley Kubrick called him up on the phone. And he said, I'm Stanley Kubrick, and I understand you're the weapons expert in Hollywood. You're a gun guy. You're the gun expert in Hollywood. Yes, I am the gun expert in Hollywood. I am a military expert. I can tell you anything, blah, 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 blah. And he really can. The guy knows his military history. So Kubrick says, well, I'm looking to buy a handgun for target practice, for my own personal use. For target practice, I'm looking to buy a handgun. I want to buy the best handgun that was ever manufactured. And Milius thinks about it, and he's like, well, that would be a Colt 45 Special, made in 1935. I'm saying 1935, I don't remember what it was. Right. It could be 1941. 1932, let's say it's a 1932. 1932 Colt 45 Special. That's the gun you want to get. And Kubrick said, okay, well, could you help me find one? Oh, yeah, absolutely. My one requirement is it must have never been fired.
Oh.
And Milius says, well, that's going to be difficult. That's going to be hard. Okay, so some time goes by, and Milius is looking, and finally he calls up Kubrick, and he says, I found the gun! I found one! I found one that has never been fired! And it's from a collector in Texas, of course.
Naturally.
Like, collector in Texas has one. And Kubrick is like, fantastic. But it's going to be expensive. And he's like, I don't care. Money goes to Texas. The gun goes from Texas to England. And some time passes. And Milius finds himself again back on the phone with Kubrick, and he says, so, how did you like the handgun? And Kubrick says, I loved it. I love it. I had it disassembled. I shaved off a quarter of a millimeter of the eye line and realigned the bead. I swapped out the hammer for iodized titanium. I replaced all the screws. I took off the mother of pearl and replaced it with mahogany. I reboard the barrel. I did this. I did that. And he's like, what have you done? You've ruined it. And Kubrick says, no, I made it better. And that's how Kubrick adapts work.
Right.
He's willing to take it completely apart and completely disassemble it and ruin it. Ruin what it used to be, rather.
Right.
To recreate it into what he needs it to be.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a destructive process. To anybody who loves that handgun, or to, you know, Colt, the company, or, you know, the original guy who owned it, who sold it to him, is probably upset about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But Kubrick made the perfect gun for Kubrick.
Right.
And so I've always kind of approached, because I'm a Kubrickophile, I've always kind of approached adaptations like that. Like, the original work will always exist. It
right.
will always be there.
And King always makes that point, too.
Yeah, and
the book hasn't changed.
Yeah, the book is still the book. Well, yeah. The stand has changed. He's added to it, which... Or he restored it.
Yeah.
But the movie will be this. Although we can get into THX afterwards.
Well, okay.
The Redux, I think, is a very interesting recreation of his original work. I had always kind of approached adaptations like that. And with Rules of Attraction, when the time came to adapt I actually didn't even own the rights to the material when I wrote the adaptation. I had not made a movie in a while. I had been struggling to get a film made, and I was having, to be honest, I was just having trouble getting a movie. I was having no problem getting writing work because you win an Academy Award, you have no problem getting writing work. But that in itself becomes a little bit of a trap. People start seeing you as a writer.
Right.
And I think one of the smartest things that Soderbergh ever did is immediately following Sex, Lies, and Videotape, instead of taking all the writing jobs that came to him in Hollywood, he made a point of directing Jonathan Lemkin's script.
Right.
Of, what is it? I can't even remember the name of the movie now.
The black and white movie.
No, actually, I like the black and white movie. Oh my God.
What was the second one?
The one with Jeremy Irons. I can't even remember the name of it. It's based on, well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. We're both brain farting.
I'm brain farting. Yeah. It's not really what, anyhow, reading Rules of Attraction, the book, it's almost formless. It's conflicting narrative devices. It's
Well, that fits very well in your wheelhouse.
Well, it does, but I'm not sure it fit well then. I mean, maybe because of Pulp Fiction, a little bit with the sort of intersecting, overlapping stories and sort of breaking form a little bit. People were more accepting of it, but I woke up in the middle of the night because I had gone to a very similar school in California, in Menlo Park, and a very similar school to Camden, in there, a small liberal arts college, you know, a bunch of Hollywood kids there, like Brian Medavoy and people like that. And everybody running around and just like that book. And I had been thinking about the book, and then I woke up in the middle of the night realizing how to adapt it and just went and did it. And sat down and started, because I had to get it out of my system. And then I took the script because I was like, I didn't think I could get that made, because the script, it had no page one. It had blocks of dialogue that were like 4 pages long. I did everything that you weren't supposed to do.
Right, right.
It had, you know, kind of no ending.
You're doing it on specs.
Every now
not?
And then in the script, like when, during the split screen sequence where it kind of folds together and becomes
which is a brilliant shot.
Thank you. I described the equipment that would be needed to do it, because I'd been working with motion control prior to that on some special effects stuff. And so I had been working with motion control, and so I wrote exactly what it needed. I basically wrote a technical document of how to make the movie, and then I took it and I put it into this drawer that I have of scripts that are just not ready to be made or not, you know, they're just, I just didn't think anybody, I couldn't get anything normal made at that point.
Yeah.
And so how was I going to get that made? And then Greg Shapiro, the producer of, he hadn't yet produced Zero Dark Thirty. He was just actually Nick Nolte's assistant at that time. He became friends with me, and he was trying to get another script of mine. I wrote this script about the Hotel Lutetia in Paris during the Nazi occupation. And I just didn't want to give him the script, because it's like, one, it's not ready. It's not right. It's not...
It was written for you so far, not for anybody else to read.
I didn't feel that I was even mature enough to release the script.
Hmm.
Like, I mean, it's a movie... Okay, just a little sidebar. The Hotel Lutetia is a hotel in Paris, and it was used after the Shoah, after the end of the war, as a gathering point for all of the survivors who lived in Paris to come back, and they would be there, and then people would wander the halls finding their loved ones. Well, during the occupation, it was like Gestapo headquarters, along with all the other big hotels in Paris, and they were torturing people in all those rooms. And so you go there now, and it's a very weird vibe. You know, there's a plaque on the outside that's sort of like, because as they have in Paris, these plaques that say, here died, you know, so-and-so on the 6th of May, or here died, you know, whatever, you know, machine gun to death, and you can see the bullet holes in the walls and stuff like that. And well, they have a plaque outside in front of the hotel saying what's going on, but they have a tree pushed in front of it to hide the plaque.
That
began a journey of mine to write that material, and you write it. And that's why I learned I have to be really careful about what I adapt and how I adapt it. Because with that script in particular, when you're writing about something as dark, as truly dark, real dark, not movie genre dark, real dark, it's hard. It's hard on me because I have to, as a writer, I have to be the torturer and the tortured.
Yeah.
You have to be able to sympathize with both and understand where both are coming from in order to be true to both characters.
And to not be black and white.
And I can go pretty far. And so when it came to, you know, torturing and being tortured and feeling the torture and doing the torture in a script, like as a writer, it was one of the hardest things I've ever done, and one of the most difficult, and it's just, I'm just not ready. I can't put that movie out. Nobody's going to want to see that from me. I'm not the guy to necessarily do that, but I had to write it.
Right.
So Greg was trying to get this script, and I was like, no, 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 no. And then finally I said, okay, take this. And I gave him The Rules of Attraction, and he read it. He's like, what are you doing? How come you're not making this?
Good point.
And I was like, well, I can't get the money to make it. He said, let me do it. Let me see if I can do it. And God love him, Greg went out and he got the money to make the movie. And he got it at I mean, at a moment when, after American Psycho was a big hit for the studio, and the Patrick Bateman character happens to be in the book Rules of Attraction,
yes.
He doesn't kill anybody in it, but he's in it.
Yep.
He's a character in it.
Yep.
And I remember there was a moment where we were just beginning, and Mike Pasternak, who's really the hero at Lionsgate, who got that movie made there. And I will love, if Mike's out there listening to this, I love you, Mike. Mike Pasternak was a great, great man for me, because he basically fought to get that movie made, and he sold it up, you know, the ladder there by basically saying it's American Psycho 2.
Right.
And at one point they were like, why don't you just call it American Psycho 2 : The Rules of Attraction. And I had to say no. And that was because there's always a point as a filmmaker when you have to walk away. You have to be willing to walk away.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to say no. And it's always that moment where the movie either falls apart or doesn't. And it actually happened on this movie every day. It was like that.
And I've done that. I've walked away.
Yeah. And I've done that.
It's
I've walked away from more movies than I've made. And
it's
so
painful.
Obviously, I've walked away from more movies than I've walked away from a movie a year, it seems. but it's mostly because, you know, when you're making a film, the people that you like, you're going to war when you make a movie. It's, you know, you have to be organized. You have to be that's why John Milius kind of understands cinema, is because he understands war. You have to be willing to take your troops and go into battle. You're either going to fight an away battle, which is more difficult and requires supply line chains and shit like that. And you're fighting, you know, in an uncertain environment. You've got Confederates you're uncertain of, you know, it's more difficult. Or you can do a home battle, which is immediately easier, but you still got all these like issues that you have to deal with that are, you know, weather issues and supply issues.
And every minute of your day is the movie.
Yeah. And every minute it becomes the only thing that there is.
You can't have a life.
Yeah. There is no life. And so, yeah.
Well, we are going beyond our usual length, but happily so.
That's normal for me.
Yeah. But that's great. But I do want to talk about criticism, because you are aware of film criticism. You read it, you study it academically. You're into film criticism. You talk about it on the podcast and the like. Rules of Attraction got wildly divergent reactions.
Euphoria seems to have gotten all my good press. Yeah.
but
God bless
you. I know what it feels like to get terrible reviews and to get really good reviews. And anyone who says they don't read them, more power to them. I don't believe most of them.
When Killing Zoe came out, I was in the south of France working on a TV movie. And when it came out, I remember I was on set and I got delivered like, oh, here's all your reviews and from England. And I was like, oh, I'm so excited.
Yay!
And I sat down like at lunch or whatever. And I was like sitting alone at a table and, you know, people hadn't yet gotten their meal. And I started taking out the reviews and I started reading them and I started crying.
Oh.
They were so, like, the British the Brit critics are so intense. Like, when
cleverly
they don't
mean.
Like you. Oh, they turn the knife after they've stabbed you. They're, like, just gutting you with it. And I've never heard such terrible things. Well, I have, actually. But at that point, it brought me to tears. And I was weeping at the lunch table. And people would walk up, like, to sit down. And they'd just turn away. Because they're, like, crying.
Well,
like,
you are your work.
Yeah, I mean, it was so hard. You know, you labor so hard to make something and to, you know, to serve the material and to make something and to put it on screen. And you're naked in many ways. You're standing up there naked.
If you're really good at what you do, you are naked.
Yeah. If you're really true to yourself, you're naked up there. And then next thing you know, people are just crapping all over it. And, you know,
how do you deal with it?
I cried,
but
these days it's different. Like, I now understand that's just part of it. And also, a movie has many lives. You know, when I first saw Blade Runner, at the South Bay Cinemas, the UA South Bay, I remember I saw the movie with a friend and I hated Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm like a science fiction horror guy. I like you. This is like my lifeblood.
Yeah.
And I go to that movie and I'm like, blah, it's awful. It's Harrison Ford leaning on a piano, plunking a piano key. and staring up at windows and just boring, dumb. I hated it. Okay, Roger. A few, you know, years later, I saw the movie again and I was like, what was I thinking? Like, yeah, what was going on with me?
Yeah.
Well, what was going on is that movies are different depending on whatever chapter in your life you're in.
Exactly.
Whatever you're experiencing, you interpret all of that stuff differently and it comes off the screen. And so you can watch different movies at different times of your life and appreciate them in different ways and understand them in different ways. And like, maybe like, you know, I don't know why this pops into my head, but maybe you think Kramer versus Kramer is just a boring ass movie until you've lived it.
Right,
and then
right.
It's like, well, now it's a movie I can relate to or something like that.
Well, just one last question. How did parenthood change you as a filmmaker, as a creator?
Well, it's funny because I...
Your daughter Gala is sitting right next to you.
She was like very, very young when I did Rules of Attraction, actually. She was during the Academy Awards, my wife was actually pregnant with Gala. And so she was born shortly after that. And then by the time Killing Zoe came around... I mean, I'm sorry, by the time Rules of Attraction came around, you know, I was making that film and I was, you know, I had a young family. I have my son as well. And so I had two kids and, you know, I was, I think, pretty suburban, actually.
Yeah.
I remember Oliver Stone came over to my house once after Rules of Attraction. He was thinking about the, he wanted to meet with me and talk with me. He loved the movie. He saw the movie and he's like, oh my God, I've got to meet you. And he came to my house and I was living in Manhattan Beach at the time. In like, you know, a neighborhood in a house that looks like a normal house and we have furniture and, you know, it's like, it's all made up and my wife has got like doilies and things, you know, like the pillows and throws and things like that. And he came in and he was like, this isn't your house. This is like, you're putting me on. And I don't believe it. And he thought I was faking him out, like that he assumed that I was some kind of punk filmmaker.
Because of your aggressive cinema.
But really what it was, Mick, was that I thought I was not ever going to make another movie. And I was like, this might be my last movie. I've managed to get to this point and the script is pretty far out and I keep telling them this is what it is and they keep letting me move forward. I mean, almost everything I wanted, I got while making that movie. Even though the budget, except for the budget.
Well, there's always that. Yeah.
I mean, my budget was $10 million and I was like, it was actually like $998 million.
Right.
And it was just under 10. I was like, I can't make it for a dime less. And they said, well, we're not making it then. And so I sat down with Mike Pasternak and in one like sitting in like about an hour and a red pen, I just went through the budget and cut everything.
Yeah.
I cut air conditioning. I cut craft service. I cut it all. And I think just the act of me sitting there with a red pen, cutting my salary, cutting this, cutting that, cutting everything out of it. And these executives sitting there watching, knowing that they have the money to make the movie.
Of course they do.
And telling me that, well, you know, we'll give you four, you know, to make it. Okay. To cut $6 million out of any budget, off of a $10 million budget, to cut any budget in half, is not easy, as anyone will tell you.
Yeah.
You've got to start cutting weeks. You've got to start cutting impossible things to cut.
Yeah.
I cut everything. And I think just watching me do that gave them faith in me. And also the fact that I was now making the movie for less. But then at that point, Nick Meyer, who was the guy who did foreign sales at Lionsgate, he was at that table. He saw what I did. And then he suddenly became my new best friend as far as like, I'm going to like upsell this movie. He made sure that even though the sales numbers weren't high enough, that he fudged them.
Hmm.
Like Shannon Sossaman at that moment, nobody was really certain about, you know, her in the role. They wanted
wonderful.
Me to cast another actress. And I wanted Shannon at that point. But, you know, it was uncertain and they weren't sure. But he fudged the numbers on everybody. And actually, even the jury was out on whether bringing in all these kind of, I mean, I don't want to belittle in any way
WB
by saying
people.
WB actors, yeah. But
So did part of that sense of responsibility come from parenthood? I still want to get back.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, actually, it hasn't changed him at all.
Yeah, it hasn't changed me at all. No, I would say that parenthood hasn't really changed me, except for the fact that as my daughter has grown up and has been working with me, has been like producing movies with me, for me, and is now working with me on the podcast. We've been working together for how long?
12 years now.
Wow. About 12 years. So when she was 15, it was like, okay, off we go to work on a TV series in Canada. And was that the one we went to worked on first? And it's been like that ever since. And, you know, really what it was is having my daughter with me and working with me keeps me honest and it keeps me kind of pure in a way. Like the Roger that you're getting here is actually the real Roger, I presume, because I don't lie in front of my daughter. Am I lying at all?
You can't lie in front
good
of
for you.
Yeah.
And so, good for you.
And so, I don't know that it really changed me.
It deepened you.
It deepened me. It gave me a greater appreciation. I think as I've grown older, like other experiences in life, I was in a terrible accident and it was my fault and I did time. I was incarcerated for a while. Coming out of that, I had a different kind of perspective on existence and how precious everything is and how delicate and the balance of life is, that I have a greater appreciation and I'm a little less, I would say now, a little less haphazard with how I say things, because my greatest frustration is when my work has been misunderstood. Mm-hmm. When Rules of Attraction first came out, you mentioned like kind of the checkered reviews that it was getting. I was getting great reviews in France, and actually England really made up for they really, because they do the opposite as well. Yeah. When they're not turning the knife, they're lionizing you, and they really, the British critics who, they were really good to me with Rules of Attraction.
You're sharing it with your progeny. You're sharing your work and your personal life together, continuing into her adulthood and all. That's a pretty phenomenal place to be.
Well, if I was a cobbler, she would like learn how to make shoes. And if I was a cooper, we would be making barrels. But
you're doing
it
together.
And yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
And it's really been an opportunity for me to like to take the things that I love and then introduce them to her. And which I, when she was younger and before we were actually working together, I probably did things too soon. Like I would expose her to like, well, Polanski's The Tenant. Well, here's a comedy gala. Let's watch a comedy.
Yeah. You'll get this.
you'll love this.
Yeah.
Sorry about that, gala.
We've barely scratched the surface and there's so much more to your professional life that we can get into. And I hope we can do this again, but we need to wrap it up now.
No worries. I know that I'm like a gab fest.
That's what this show is about. It's learning about artists and who they are and how they function.
I didn't always used to be this way. I actually when I was doing my Victor European trip that you see in Rules of Attraction in 1987, after working at Empire, I went and traveled around Europe, and one place I went to was Blarney Castle in Ireland. And I don't even know if you're allowed to do this anymore, but I kissed the Blarney Stone.
I did.
You did? Yeah. So you too. So you understand. I've got the gift of gab. I was asking my wife today, is it a curse? Like I always thought it was a blessing, but is it a curse?
It can be both. Well, thank you so much for coming here in Gala. I'm glad you were here to accompany. And good luck with all of the stuff. And thank you for all of the great entertainment and the podcast. Anyone who hasn't listened to it yet, it's called Video Archives, and it's available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's really a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.